This guy who is visiting the class this morning on my left here, John Lippert, is a guy that I have known since 1982. We were in the THM program together. He's one of my oldest and dearest friends. Some of you will be surprised to find out that I have a friend, and John hopefully will be a testimony to that fact. I'm not going to tell any of the stories that I could tell on John this morning for two reasons. One, his wife is here, and secondly, that hopefully if I don't tell any of those stories, he might come back. So I'm going to behave myself this morning. But if any of you would like to know any of them, I'll be hanging around for about 15 minutes after class, and we'll be happy to fill you in then. We're talking about how to find a wife this morning. And so we have a whole chapter from the Bible on how to find a wife. I didn't follow any of these principles and ended up with more than a man has the right to expect. But an entire chapter in the Bible is given over to the topic. So now, see, this poses a problem because I think most of the guys in here are married. Some of you aren't, and so this might have particular application to those of you who aren't. Those of you who are shouldn't consider applying this chapter in order to find an alternative or a second one, right? This doesn't apply to you, so you guys who are married, you can just switch off. Those ladies might just want to listen so they know something about the wolves who are out there and can learn something about what goes on in the entire process. We are in Genesis chapter 29, and everything I just said is completely untrue. This chapter will appeal to many as a lesson on how to find a wife, but that's not what the chapter is about at all. And some will want to read the chapter as a way of understanding how to get out of God what they want to get out of God. Some people will read this chapter and say, aha, this is the way it happened to so-and-so, and so if I'm just like so-and-so, then I'll get exactly from God what so-and-so got, because that's what I want. The chapter isn't about that either. What is the chapter about? The chapter is again about this very real point, that God has a plan that he wants to accomplish for the world. And God is going to accomplish his plan for the world by using certain people of certain character. God will use people of praiseworthy character, but we're also going to see that God, for some reason, uses people of character that we would want to have nothing whatsoever to do with. The point of the chapter is this: you don't always get out of God what you want to get out of God, and God doesn't always give you what you want him to give you. But God will give you what he wants to give you for his greater, broader, redemptive purpose of bringing salvation to the world. Before we get into this chapter, you all have got to get used to something, and that is God is interested in more people than just you, and that he will use you. He will employ you, he will position you, he will give to you, he will take from you in order to accomplish his broader redemptive purposes of bringing Satan to nothing, of bringing death to an end, of bringing eternal life to all who will believe, of redeeming and cleansing our world of unjust actions and unrighteousness and the filthiness and corruption which characterizes it. God is interested in cleaning up the whole mess. And he will use you as he sees fit in order to clean that mess up. It's not about you, it's about us. It's not about us, it's about the entire world. It's not about the entire world. It's about the entire universe, which has become corrupted by sin, and which God is moving every second in order to bring incorruption out of corruption, in order to bring life out of death, in order to bring righteousness out of unrighteousness, in order to bring truth out of lies. So are you willing to be a part of God's greater purpose? We're in Genesis chapter 29. And in Genesis 29, we find that Jacob goes a wife hunting. A hunting we will go. A hunting we will go. Hi-ho, a merry-o. A hunting we will go. Then Jacob continued on his journey and came to the land of the eastern peoples. Those are people who live in New York, Washington, D.C., Boston. There he saw a well in the field with three flocks of sheep lying near it because the flocks were watered from that well. The stone over the mouth of the well was large. When all the flocks were gathered there, the shepherds would roll the stone away from the well's mouth and water the sheep. Then they would return the stone to its place over the mouth of the well. Jacob asked the shepherds, "My brothers, where are you from?" "We're from Haran," they replied. He said to them, "Do you know Laban, Nahor's grandson?" "Yes, we know him," they answered. Then Jacob asked them, "Is he well?" "Yes, he is," they said. "And here comes his daughter Rachel with the sheep." "Look," he said, "the sun is still high. It is not time for the flocks to be gathered. Water the sheep and take them back to the pasture." "We can't," they replied, "until all the flocks are gathered and the stone has been rolled away from the mouth of the well, then we will water the sheep." While he was still talking with them, Rachel came from her father's sheep, for she was a shepherdess. Something for all of you ladies to aspire to. When Jacob saw Rachel, daughter of Laban, his mother's brother, and Laban's sheep, he went over and rolled the stone away from the mouth of the well and watered his uncle's sheep. Then Jacob kissed Rachel and began to weep aloud. In my experience, it's usually the other way around. But here, Jacob is the one who weeps. Yeah, I know that, Steve, but thanks. He had told Rachel that he was a relative of her father and a son of Rebekah. So she ran and told her father. As soon as Laban heard the news about Jacob, his sister's son, he hurried to meet him. He embraced him and kissed him and brought him to his home, and there Jacob told him all these things. Then Laban said to him, "You are my own flesh and blood." So get the picture of what's happened here. Jacob is there with his sheep. He is watering his sheep. The daughter of his uncle, right? What do you call her? His what? His cousin. The first instance of kissing cousins here in the Bible, right? So he's found his mother's family. He's met his uncle's daughter. He's greeted her with a kiss. He's wept for joy of having met her. And his uncle runs and greets him full of joy that he's had a chance to meet his nephew. That's the stage so far. After Jacob had stayed with him for a whole month, Laban said to him, "Just because you are a relative of mine, should you work for me for nothing? Tell me what your wages should be." Now Laban had two daughters. The name of the older one was Leah, and the name of the younger was Rachel. Leah had weak eyes, but Rachel was lovely in form and beautiful. Jacob was in love with Rachel and said, "I'll work for you 7 years in return for your younger daughter, Rachel." Wow. 7 years hard labor, And he's asking in return Rachel as his wife. Now, get a couple of things here. The text has explicitly told you, right, that Rachel is the younger daughter, and Leah is the elder. Leah is the firstborn daughter, and Rachel is the secondborn. In Eastern tradition, in Eastern family practice, right, the younger is never married off first. It is an overwhelming insult to the elder daughter. The elder daughter always gets married first, and then only after the elder daughter is married can the younger daughter be married. That's just the way it works. But Jacob has appeared on the scene, and he's been struck in love, right, with the one who is, did you catch it? Lovely in form and beautiful. You see, it wasn't just enough for Moses to write beautiful. He had to tell you two different ways that this girl apparently is a knockout. We can think of the term gorgeous. We can think of the term very, very pretty. But what Moses is really trying to say here in two words is what you and I would simply say, she was a babe. Right? This girl apparently is just magnificently attractive physically. And this is the one, of course, that Jacob is fixated upon. He falls in love with her. He is overcome with her. He can't get her out of his mind. Did you notice the way in which the text described the elder daughter? Leah had weak eyes. Yes, sirree, that's the way that we want to describe our daughters, isn't it? This is my pretty daughter, and this is my other daughter who has weak eyes. What you don't want to confuse is what we frequently in our own language mean by weak. Weak in our own language can frequently be a very derogatory term, meaning unproductive, meaning a weakling. You get the picture of those old advertisements in the old comic books about the built man who lifts weights and the 98-pound weakling who gets sand kicked in his face. When we hear the word weak, we think of something derogatory, something unattractive, something which is the opposite of power and strength. That's not what the text means here. Do any of your other translations have a different word other than weak when it describes her eyes? Ah, that's a much better translation. Delicate, gentle, delicate or gentle is the better translation here for weak. As a matter of fact, this term in the Bible is never used in a negative way. It's always used to describe someone or something that is gentle and delicate, something that is fragile. Think of your finest crystal. Think of something that is precious. Think of something that is gentle and that you treat with care. Because they are gentle and fragile and delicate. The Bible here is using a physical part of her body, her eyes, in order to tell you something about her soul, something about her character. Do we talk like this even today? If I were to tell you he has angry eyes, what would I be telling you? He's a mean guy, right? We use the eyes, and we use descriptive nouns of the eyes in order to communicate things about a person's soul or a person's heart. That's what the text is doing in this case. In other words, here is the contrast that Moses is setting up between the two girls. Leah is a gentle woman. Leah is a gentle, kind woman. You look into her eyes and what you see is gentleness. Notice that the text doesn't say anything about the eyes of Rachel. Instead, all the text tells you about Rachel is that she has a lovely form and she's beautiful. The text here is setting up a contrast for you between these two girls. One has a character that needs to be mentioned, a character which is praiseworthy and a character which is godly. As a matter of fact, a character, as we'll see later, which is one of the fruits of the Spirit. Gentleness is one of the fruits of the Spirit. The text wants you to know that this elder daughter is a woman of character, such character that it needs to be stated and contrasted with mere passing, transitory physical beauty. But Jacob goes for the girl who is physically attractive and passes completely by the one of character. This is really astounding because I've never met a man who did that. When I read this story, I just fell over backwards because most men that I know go for the character before the beauty. Well, the text here is trying to make a point for you, and we'll see exactly what the text makes. So Jacob, verse 18, was in love with Rachel and said, "I'll work for you 7 years in return for your younger daughter, Rachel." Laban said, "It's better to give her to you than to some other man, because you're in the family, right? Stay here with me." So Jacob served 7 years to get Rachel, but they seemed like only... This is such a romantic verse. But they seemed like only a few days to him, because of his love for her. I mean, that sounds like something you'd read in a romance novel. That sounds like something Pierce Brosnan or Mel Gibson or Paul Newman would say in some wonderful Wine and Roses movie. Right? He worked 7 years, but they seemed only a few days to him because he was in such love with her. Well, he really was. I mean, he was really captivated by this gal. And the text wants you to know the degree to which Jacob has been claimed in his heart by the beauty of this woman. With no appreciation, first of all, for the custom of his family, that the elder daughter always gets married off first, and no appreciation for the character of the eldest daughter. All he can see is the physicality. All he can see are the beads and the trinkets. All he can see is the outwardness of this woman, and that's all he cares about. The text wants you to see Jacob as a shallow, shallow man. A man who is not spiritually mature, a man who doesn't recognize the value of the heart and of the character which is inside a person. Jacob is a shallow man. Then Jacob, verse 21, said to Laban, "Give me my wife. My time is completed, and I want to lie with her." So Laban brought together, notice, right? Notice also the emphasis upon his total consummation, right, with the physical relationship. That's what he's been waiting 7 years for, and that's the first thought off of his mind. He wants to lie with the beautiful one. Then Jacob said to Laban, "Give me my wife. My time is completed, and I want to lie with her." So Laban brought together all the people of the place and gave a feast. But when evening came, he took his daughter Leah and gave her to Jacob. And Jacob lay with her. And Laban gave his servant girl Zilpah to his daughter as her maidservant. When morning came, there was Leah. So Jacob said to Laban, "What is this you have done to me? I served you for Rachel, didn't I? Why have you deceived me?" Now, first of all, there are a couple of questions that come immediately to mind here, right? Yeah, did you hear what Dr. Madeley just said? Dr. Madeley just said it wasn't Rachel who had the weak eyes, right? Jacob's the one with the... I don't know, this guy had cataracts. They had the feast, there was too much wine. They didn't want to do it in the light, they wanted to do it in the darkness. You know, who knows? But notice the question, right? Did you catch the question? Why have you deceived me? Remember who's asking this question. Right, the great deceiver, Jacob, has now been deceived. Oh, and it hurts. Remember the little trick he pulled on his brother? Yeah. Notice the poetic justice that God is writing into the life of Jacob. The deceiver gets deceived. You think you got away with it, don't you? You think you got away with it. I don't know what it is, but you've convinced yourself that you are so talented that you've crossed all the T's and dotted all the I's. Your wife doesn't know. Your husband doesn't know. Your children don't know. Your employers don't know. I don't know what it is, but whatever it is unjust or unmerciful or impure, and you think you've gotten away with it. You've closed all the doors so no one can go in. You've shut all the windows so no one can see in. You don't think that anybody's ever going to find you out because you've been so careful in wiping away all the fingerprints, in dusting away all the footprints. You think you haven't lost a trail. You think that you've gotten away scot clean. But you know what? God, in his redemptive, poetic justice, brings about deception in the life of the deceiver. If you live by the sword, you will die by the sword. If you live with impurity, impurity will be done to you. If you are unrighteous, unrighteousness will be done to you. If you are unjust, you will suffer from injustice. God is in the business of bringing poetic justice. And in this case, the deceiver has been deceived. What is this you have done to me? How could you deceive me? Laban replied, "It is not our custom here to give the younger daughter in marriage before the older one. Finish out this daughter's bridal week, then we will give you the younger one also in return for another 7 years of work." And Jacob did so. He finished out the week with Leah, and then Laban gave him his daughter Rachel to be his wife. Laban gave his servant girl Bilhah to his daughter Rachel as her maidservant. Jacob lay with Rachel also. And here are the most hurtful words of the chapter. And he loved Rachel more than Leah. Where have you heard that line before in this dysfunctional, corrupt family? Exactly. Rebekah loved Jacob more. You see, this is a family that has been living in favoritism since the get-go. His parents had two sons, but the text is clear. Each parent had a favorite. Each parent treated one son better than the other. Each parent had a favorite. And so it's been passed right on down to Jacob and the hurtful words. And don't you know that even if the words were never spoken to Leah, don't you know that every day she had to live in the house with that man, knowing that he loved her younger sister more than her? Can you imagine the tears? Can you imagine the sleepless nights? Can you imagine the prayers, knowing that you're the unloved one? Notice what happens. When the Lord saw, verse 31, that Leah was not loved, he opened her womb, but Rachel was barren. Leah became pregnant and gave birth to a son. She named him Reuben, for she said, "It is because the Lord has seen my misery. Surely my husband will love me now." It's not going to happen. You see, everything in her life now pivots around doing actions and receiving blessings that will cause Jacob to love her. That's all she can think of. Her mind is consumed with that. What can I do to make him love me? And so the first thought is that now I've got a son, surely he'll love me now. Nope. No, he loves the beautiful one. He loves Rachel. She conceived again, verse 33, and when she gave birth to a son, she said, "Because the Lord heard that I am not loved, he gave me this one too." So she named him Simeon. Again she conceived, and when she gave birth to a son, she said, "Now at last my husband will become attached to me, because I have borne him three sons." So he was named Levi. She conceived again, and when she gave birth to a son, she said, "This time I will praise the Lord." So she named him Judah. Then she stopped having children. Sad story. What is the Lord, through Moses, trying to tell us through such a sad, desperate tale? Once you see the names of her sons, I want to focus just on two of them this morning. I want to focus, first of all, upon the last one. What was the name of the last one? Judah. Would you all keep your finger right there in Genesis, and would you turn to the first chapter of Matthew? Matthew chapter 1. Many women will read this chapter who are barren and will claim this chapter as what God will do for them. And many women who claim this chapter will find that God doesn't do for them the same thing that he did for Leah. This chapter is not about a promise from God that every woman who is barren or every woman who is unloved by her husband or every woman who struggles trying to win the love of her husband will ultimately, by the act of God, have children or find that her husband has a change of heart. That's not what this chapter is about. I am so sorry to tell you. This chapter is not setting the paradigm that for every hurting woman, there is a merciful God who will give her what her heart mourns for. This chapter is about something else. Look at the first chapter of Matthew and read with me just a few of the first verses. A record of the genealogy of Jesus Christ, the son of David, the son of Abraham. Abraham was the father of Isaac, Isaac the father of Jacob, Jacob the father of Judah. What we have just seen happen here is that God has intervened into human history to bring blessing to the entire world because Judah was the father of Jesus' father. And God has intervened here into the world to bring blessing to the whole world through Leah, through the one of weak eyes, through the one of gentle eyes, through the one of fragile character. God has moved in order to use this drastic, loveless, hurtful, sad situation in order to bring joy, life, resurrection, salvation, forgiveness, light to the entire world through Jesus Christ. Rachel's the beautiful one. Rachel's the one of lovely form and of beauty, but it's through the one of weak eyes that salvation is brought to the world. It's through the one of gentle character. It's through the one who is consumed with misery and a daily, daily cry to God to be loved by her husband that God brings blessing to the world. He does not bring it through the beautiful one. He does not bring it to the one who is decked out in the finest garments, who has the biggest bank account, who drives the nicest car, who has the biggest house, who has all of the physical, observable bounty of the world. He does not bring blessing to the world through the beauty of this world. He brings blessing to the world through the one who is of gentle character. Just allow me to read some biblical texts to you. Just a few biblical texts. But first, let me give you a definition of gentleness. To be gentle is to be considerate or kindly in manner. To be considerate or kindly in manner. To be mild, to be soft. Gentleness is gradual. It's not steep, and it's not sudden. Gentleness is gradual. It's incremental. It doesn't shock or scare. It's not a bucket of ice water in the face. It's gradual. Let me read to you some biblical texts on gentleness. Galatians 5:22. But the fruit of the Spirit is gentleness. Galatians 5:1. Brothers, even if a man is caught in some fault, you who are spiritual must restore such a one in a spirit of gentleness. Ephesians 4:2. Put up with one another. Put up with one another in love with all gentleness and quiet behavior. Philippians 4:5. Let your gentleness be known to all men. 1 Timothy 6:11. But you, man of God, if you think that gentleness is a female character, Paul says, but you, male, you man of God, follow after gentleness. James 3:13, who is wise and understanding among you? Let him show by his good conduct that his deeds are done in gentleness of wisdom. Here are what wise men have said about gentleness. Buscaglia said this, only the weak are cruel. Only the weak are cruel. Gentleness can only be expected from the strong. Gentleness is the indicator of strength. St. Francis de Sales said this, nothing is so strong as gentleness. Nothing so gentle as real strength. Lord Chesterfield, Let your enemies be disarmed by the gentleness of your manner. Phaedrus, a Roman fabulist. Gentleness is the antidote for cruelty. Leo Rostin, an American novelist, said this, "I learned that it is the weak who are cruel, and that gentleness is to be expected only from the strong." Now, a few texts on beauty. Would you come with me? Proverbs 31. Proverbs 31 and verse 30. Proverbs 31, 30. Charm is deceptive and beauty is fleeting. But a woman who fears the Lord is to be praised. I'm a very fortunate man, I got both. But a woman who fears the Lord is to be praised. 1 Timothy chapter 2. Verse 9. I also want women to dress modestly, with decency and propriety, not with braided hair or gold or pearls or expensive clothes, but with good deeds, appropriate for women who profess to worship God. The apostle puts the emphasis where it belongs, and that is with a woman who fears the Lord. 1 Peter chapter 3. 1:1. Wives, in the same way, be submissive to your husbands, so that if any of them do not believe the word, they may be won over without talk by the behavior of their wives, when they see the purity and reverence of your lives. Your beauty should not come from outward adornment, such as braided hair and the wearing of gold jewelry and fine clothes. Instead, it should be that of your inner self, the unfading beauty of a gentle and quiet spirit, which is of great worth in God's sight. This isn't only about women. Would you turn to 1 Samuel chapter 16? It's in the Old Testament. It's before the kings, right after Judges. 1 Samuel chapter 16. Beauty, physical stature, physical appearance is not an issue that is relegated to women. Notice the words of verse 7 here. But the Lord said to Samuel, "Do not consider his appearance or his height, for I have rejected him. The Lord does not look at the things man looks at. Man looks at the outward appearance. But the Lord looks at what? The Lord looks at the heart." Moses is trying to teach us here in the 29th chapter is that God looks at our hearts. And he will use us in a way which is consistent with bringing redemption to the whole world based upon what is in our hearts. God does not look at your outward appearance. He does not care whether you're wearing something from Sears or Penney's, or whether you're wearing something from one of the couture galleries or boutiques. He just does not care. He's looking much deeper. His eyes are penetrating into your character, and he is asking, what is your heart like? He's not looking at our pearls, our watches. He's not looking at our suits or our dresses. He is looking at our hearts, and he is asking, are you one of weak eyes? Are you one of gentle spirit? Are you one of kindness? Are you one who treats people as if they are fragile? The Lord is peering into your heart this morning, and he's trying to find gentleness. Will he find it? Will he find something soft, or will he find something harsh? Will he find something mean, or will he find something tender? Will he find something that is gradual, or will he find something that wants to be sudden? Will he find something that is tender and soft, or will he find something that is hard and cold? The fruit of the Spirit is gentleness. So in just our last few moments here, help me understand. Would you give us some examples of what gentleness looks like? What does gentleness look like? Where have you seen gentleness in your world or in your life? I'm sorry? Give me some specifics. What does that look like? A mother with a baby is a wonderful model for what we should be doing with other people who are no longer babies. What else does gentleness look like? Yes.
Well, along the same line, we have a daughter, our daughter-in-law has five children, and she just had the fifth. But even though she's nursed them all, she still has to be very careful and loving with her other children because they still need her. And so she doesn't just push the baby away.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting how often in trying to describe gentleness, the term kindness comes up. What else does gentleness look like? Yes. Phone calls, expressions of concern, offers to pray, offers to act in other ways. Absolutely. Letting you know that you were not far from our minds and our hearts. Thank you. Yeah. It is so good. It is so helpful. Yeah. Yes.
Rather than yourself. Every single person on the face of the earth, exactly the same.
That is very, very good.
Exactly the same.
Exactly. Yeah. Very helpful. So what will you do this week in order to be gentle? Who in your life, who within your sphere of influence, who within your orbit needs gentleness from you this week? And What will you do in order to take your eyes off of the physical beauty of this world in order to love with greater depth somebody's character? And what will you do this week in order to nurture your own character over and above the degree to which you nurture and attempt to maintain that which is so quickly fading? Father, we ask that by the power of the Spirit, you would help us to be consumed with that which is interior, that which is of the heart. Help us to nurture our own characters so much more highly than we nourish our outward features. Help us to praise the interior qualities of those around us with much more regularity than we do their outward. Help us to be found by you to be men and women of gentleness. And would you see fit to use us in the way in which you used this woman to bring blessing to the world, for we know that that is your heart and that is your purpose. We would be pleased to be used by you. So we ask you, by the Spirit that indwells us and whose fruit is gentleness, to make us men and women of kindness and softness, of patient, moment-by-moment care for others, to make us all motherly towards others without expectation of reward. We ask it through the Son and by the Spirit. Amen.